Welcome back to Coastal Connection. I'm Brian Russo. Coming up later in the program, we'll head for French Polynesia in our year-long audio series aboard the catamaran Elsie with Richard and Jessica Johnson from Oxford, Maryland. And we'll meet a woman who handles the high-priced and luxurious rental cottages and homes in Rehoboth Beach, Delaware, in the latest in our Living the Dream series. And speaking of a picturesque ocean view, have you ever thought about how much that oceanfront view is costing you? We're not talking about just the price of your hotel room or home prices either. We're referring to a more hidden cost, one that's paid by the federal government to repair coastlines damaged by increasingly destructive storms. Theo Meyer with the investigative journalism website ProPublica recently did some digging, looking at how much money the feds spend through various programs and whether taxpayers are getting a good return on that investment. He joins us now by phone from New York City. Theo Meyer, thanks for joining me here on Coastal Connection.
Thank you for having me.
So your article focused a lot on Ocean City, New Jersey. You started out your story by looking at what the federal government was spending in the wake of Hurricane Sandy and then over the years as well. Tell me about what you found just concerning Superstorm Sandy.
Well, I looked at Ocean City, New Jersey, just as a sort of an example of the various subsidies that the federal government has for coastal living and coastal development. What I found was that in Ocean City, the federal government had recently finished a beach nourishment project where the federal government pays to put sand back onto beaches where it has been washed away by erosion, storms, etc.
Mm-hmm.
The federal government finished a program to do this in May. They paid roughly $14 million of the $18 million tab to do this. But this wasn't the first time that the federal government had done this. It had also paid to restore Ocean City, New Jersey's beaches in 2010, according to some data that's been compiled by Western Carolina University. It did the same thing in 2004 and in 2000. And in total, Washington has spent about $40 million, at least, on nine separate efforts to restore the city's beaches in the last 20 years.
It's interesting because people that live here on the coast in Ocean City, Maryland, or even coastal Delaware, you know, they're very used to beach replenishment. It's been going on for years. Just as you described, every few years, the Army Corps of Engineers comes down and they sort of build up that natural levee that the dune system provides. And proponents of beach replenishment always point to the, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars, some even say billions of dollars worth of, you know, property values that have been saved because that dune system is in place. This is a lot of money that we're talking about here, and this is a lot of money that the federal government is doling out. What have you found based on, you know, your research and your story about the feeling for people that don't live on the coast, for their tax money going into programs such as beach replenishment?
Well, I talked to a number of scientists, as well as a couple of you know, people who work in Washington in think tanks and et cetera. And sort of the feeling was, if this is so valuable to people who live on the coast, why aren't these coastal communities paying for beach nourishment themselves rather than having the federal government chip in so much money? And the federal government has been paying or helping to pay for beach nourishment for such a long time that we really don't have any idea of, you know, what the Jersey Shore would look like if there wasn't this subsidy there.
You know, here on the coast, just in Ocean City, Maryland, for instance, I know that that beach replenishment program goes on. It's almost like a team effort. It's the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. It's the state of Maryland. It is the local jurisdiction here in Worcester County. So it's a partnership between federal, state, and county as well. Are you finding that with other, you know, beach resorts throughout the country, specifically in New Jersey, let's say?
Yeah, certainly communities do sometimes pay for their own beach replenishment, or the state sometimes pays for it. But in many instances, it's the federal government who's taking the lead and paying for, say, 65% of a project. The state will chip in for maybe another quarter, and the community will, you know, chip in for maybe 10% of the total cost or so.
You know, in your article, you outlined four different federal programs that are used to help repair and restore beaches, the Stafford Act, the National Flood Insurance Program, the beach nourishment or replenishment efforts, as we were talking about, and then casualty loss deduction. Tell me about those, and is there one of them that you think is the best for everyone involved, not just coastal residents, but people who just, you know, live in landlocked areas very far from the coast?
One of them is this law called the Stafford Act, which lets the president declare a disaster, and then he can, sort of pour federal aid into the individual states and individual counties that have been affected. This law commits the federal government to paying typically about 75% of the cost of rebuilding infrastructure in these places, you know, the roads, the bridges, and such.
Mm-hmm.
But there's no requirement that these bridges be built back any better or be built to withstand rising sea levels or anything like that. The money often goes to well-off communities. A classic example from one scientist I talked to, which the New York Times wrote about last year, is a coastal town called Dauphin Island, Alabama, where the Times reported that the federal government had spent at least $80 million rebuilding it since 1979. That's just infrastructure. That's not houses.
Critics of beach replenishment programs argue that, you know, they just merely encourage development in places that are prone, that are very prone to flooding. Every time we see a major storm, Sandy, Irene, even just nor'easters that we see up and down, there is significant erosion. And then seemingly beach replenishment programs come back and pump money in to fix what would, you know, natural storms have taken away. But on the other side of it, beach communities are very important, you know, state and local economic engines. How much do you think that the tax revenue and you know, all of the economic engine that beach towns bring in should be brought into this conversation about whether or not federal government should do these programs?
Well, there's no question that beach nourishment is critical for many coastal towns, that their entire economies are oriented around the beach. And if the beach is washing away, you know, that's their economy washing away.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the key points that several of the scientists I talked to brought up is that if you don't have, you know, a hotel behind the beach or a boardwalk and a line of homes, the beach isn't going to erode away. If it's just in a, you know, sort of a natural state, there may be erosion of the land, but the beach will just sort of be pushed back along with that land. So the subsidy isn't necessarily so much for the beach itself. It's for the usually privately owned buildings that are behind the beach.
After Hurricane Sandy, you heard harsh critics of beach replenishment coming in and saying, you know what, storms are getting worse and worse. These people knew what they were getting into by purchasing property right on the ocean or right in, you know, flood-prone areas. The government should probably not be helping them anymore. And then you look at big tornadoes that happen in the Midwest, and it's the same thing. You know, that same argument is made. Those people live in Tornado Alley. You know, maybe they should just pick up and leave. And it's really not that simple. What role do you think, as storms continue to seemingly intensify, that the federal government is going to take in helping people who've had their lives turned upside down and their properties severely damaged by natural disasters like hurricanes or like tornadoes?
Well, one of the subsidies that I wrote about is the federal government's flood insurance program, which insures many people in high-risk flood areas along the coast. And in some cases, certainly people knew that they were moving into areas that were, could potentially flood in a storm. But in other cases, because of out-of-date flood maps that didn't accurately portray the risk, people certainly bought homes and were not aware that they were at risk of having them destroyed. So when the federal government stops subsidizing these kinds of properties, you know, resulting in higher insurance rates, that can be a real problem. You can see insurance rates shooting from maybe a couple of $1,000s a year to, now that some of these subsidies are being phased out, to, you know, $20,000 a year. And many, many, many people cannot afford to pay that.
As storms continue to intensify and municipal, local, federal governments continue to tighten the belt, financially speaking, where do you think this debate is going to go? Do you think it's going to kind of stay on the fringes of the national conversation where it's been, or do you think it's going to kind of move towards the front a little bit?
Well, I can tell you that last year Congress passed a series of sort of broad reforms of the National Flood Insurance Program, which fell almost $20 billion into debt after Hurricane Katrina, and sort of just was not taking in enough in premiums to cover the amount that it had to pay out for these hurricanes. There are now efforts in Congress, now that homeowners have found out how much their premiums are going to rise, to sort of cover the risk themselves instead of having the federal government do it.
Is it having an impact on the consumer market? I mean, are people becoming more and more hesitant about investing their hard-earned dollars into coastal properties because of, you know, the increasing intensity of storms?
You know, I am not sure whether that's the case. You mentioned the conversation around beach nourishment, and to some extent, there really isn't a lot of conversation around it. Congress approved this Sandy relief bill, or pair of Sandy relief bills, back in January, and according to one scientist I talked to, he estimated that that bill contains $3.5 billion for beach nourishment in New Jersey and elsewhere, which he said was more money than had been spent on nourishment from every source that he's been tracking in the history of the United States.
Wow.
So that certainly isn't the federal government cutting back on beach nourishment at all.
We've been speaking with Theo Meyer. He's an investigative journalist for the website ProPublica. He joined us on the phone from New York City. Theo, thanks for joining me here on Coastal Connection.
Thanks for having me.
We turn now to healthcare. And with so much of the national conversation focusing on the rising cost of healthcare, and of course from a political level, the merits of the President's Affordable Care Act, one thing that has perhaps become a footnote in that conversation is the shortage of primary care physicians. In 2011, more than 78 million baby boomers eclipsed the age of 65. And while that may focus on the increased demand for healthcare as a substantial portion of our population ages, we're also seeing a bit of a sea change from practicing physicians. In 2008, about a quarter of the physicians in practice in Maryland were 60 or older. And as they neared the end of their careers, there was a growing concern about the next generation of doctors being able to supply enough quality care for the aforementioned increased demand. Healthcare officials fear that the height of this so-called physician shortage could reach its peak by 2015. In addition, physicians with small practices, particularly in rural areas like here on the coast, they have found it increasingly difficult to survive from a business standpoint because of skyrocketing costs just to keep their practices open. So to try and gauge what the future holds for you and your primary care physician, I'm joined by Dr. Peter Anderson. He's been in the primary care physician business for more than 30 years, and he's also the founder of Team Care Medicine, which is a physician training organization. Dr. Anderson, thanks for joining me here on Coastal Connection.
Well, thank you for having me, Brian.
Let's discuss this growing concern, not just from the type of healthcare that we're going to be receiving, but the challenges from the physician standpoint. I know that over the course of your career, there was a time when your practice was losing money because of all these things that we were just talking about. Tell me about some of the things that you discovered and then implemented to turn everything around for you.
I had to change the way I delivered care. And we all think in terms of the specific medical care, which is the antibiotic, the right antibiotic for the particular kind of pneumonia, the right diabetic drug. But that's not really our problem in America. Our challenge is how do we deliver the care that our culture needs in both a cost-efficient way and in a way that allows people to get it when they need it. I was in crisis, as I said, in 2003 because I couldn't see enough patients. I wasn't available to my patients when they needed me. And because I couldn't see enough to pay the bills, we were always in sort of a chaos. Our atmosphere was really difficult because of being understaffed due to limited finances. So I changed the way I delivered care. That change in delivery worked so well that not only were we able to go from 20, 22 patients a day up to 30, 35 patients a day, our patient satisfaction went to the very top. But the thing that really surprised me, that my original intent was just to keep quality where it was, our quality excelled anything I'd ever done in the previous 20 years.
Tell me a little bit about this model.
We trained our nurses up to the very top of their license so they could help me accomplish the patient visit in primary care, just like the operating room nurse helps the surgeon accomplish the surgery in the OR. In primary care, for some reason, the physician walks in and the nurse walks out. I decided if I'm going to change anything, I've got to build a team inside the exam room. And once we figured out what the nurse could do and what I would do, and we built this team, we found that it just improved efficiency dramatically, but it allowed me to focus on the patient. And that's what I'd lost earlier, is that I had so many responsibilities in the exam room. I was focusing on five different things beside the patient.
Well, primary care physicians are such a key to good health, but with 40 million new patients coming into the system due to the aforementioned Affordable Care Act, there's so much speculation about what that's going to do. It's going to shock the system, and it's a system that's, you know, technically struggling. What do you foresee the Affordable Care Act doing to our healthcare system?
I mean, it does everything to make primary care the backbone of our healthcare system, which will improve quality dramatically and bring down cost significantly. The ACA can be a tremendous step forward for healthcare if primary care evolves into the position that the whole healthcare system needs. Now, you are right. Primary care is in crisis. We're, you know, over 40% of primary care is done in emergency rooms and urgent care centers, done by a physician or a mid-level that doesn't know the patient. And that is what's causing a huge decrease in quality and an increase in cost. But so primary care is not in a position today to really do what the ACA needs. But it has made us come to decision. Are we going to fix primary care, or are we going to continue with the same brokenness that we've had in the last 30 years? I think the Affordable Care Act could be a tremendous asset to what it helped bring into the healthcare system. But now the traditional office visit is cumbersome and inefficient, just like the house call was in the 20s. But physicians are having a hard time thinking there's a better model, because change is hard for all of us. But the immediate need today is to get physicians to reevaluate how they're delivering care and see that there is a different way.
How do you think it's going to change for the average Marylander, for the average person living in coastal Delaware?
First, we've got to realize the healthcare system in America is broken before the ACA was ever implemented or ever passed. We're throwing the economy close to a recession because we're demanding so much from employers. You know, 40 million people can't afford insurance. 50% of adults with chronic disease do not get recommended or adequate care. Those kind of figures are staggering when you see that we spend close to 18% of our GDP on health care. So the Obamacare is another sort of weight on a broken health care system, but it did not cause that. I think people need to understand that. Now, if we don't fix a health care system, that weight of Obamacare could crush everything. We could slide our whole economy into recession if we don't figure out a way to decrease costs. But if we do bring primary care back into the backbone, we will reduce costs.
We've been speaking with Dr. Peter Anderson. He was a primary care physician for more than 30 years, and then he established Team Care Medicine, a physician training organization. Dr. Anderson, thanks so much for joining me here on Coastal Connection.
Well, Brian, thank you for giving me the opportunity. It's been a pleasure.
We're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back. You're listening to Coastal Connection here on 88.3 in Ocean City, Maryland. I'm Brian Russo.